Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Kurdistan Connection with myself, Matt Broomfield, here on Media News. As regular listeners will know, here on the Kurdistan Connection, we're always trying to put what's happening in Kurdistan in its broader context, be that geopolitically, militarily, or otherwise, in terms of what's going on in the Middle East and throughout Europe and the world. It's been a significant week in the past week. It's the 25th anniversary, as listeners will probably be aware, of the capture of the Kurdish leader Abdullah Öcalan, the man sometimes known as the Mandela of the Middle East, who continues to inspire many Kurds from his jail cell. And this anniversary comes at a time when Kurdistan, like much of the rest of the Middle East, seems to be at a real crossroads, a real kind of turning point with a lot of forces seeking to exert influence on the region and very rapid geopolitical developments taking place. There have been some events in Europe to draw attention, particularly to the detention of Abdullah Öcalan, and to discuss this crisis and Kurdistan's increasingly significant role in that crisis. These conferences have been joined by international friends and supporters of the Kurdish movement, one of whom is our guest today, Benny Gustafsson. Benny, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Benny is chairman of the Support Committee for Kurdistan in Söderhamn, in Sweden, a country which actually has a particular role to play in terms of Kurdistan's wider implications throughout Europe, which we'll get to in a moment. But yeah, maybe first, Benny, you know, you've joined some events over the weekend. What were those events and why were they significant?
First, it was a conference held in the AU building in Strasbourg. No, in Brussels, sorry, with prominent guests from all over Europe. And the main topic was to free Öcalan, or to make his situation to start with better in his prison. And then we went to Colonia to join a huge demonstration as the end of a long march who stopped in Colonia.
So at this conference, what were the main topics of conversation? Why were people speaking about these issues that you raised about the detention of one man in Turkey?
We spoke mostly of the repression in Turkey, both to civilians, to the press, and mainly the people active in the former HDP party. But the main topic was Öcalan's situation.
And so, given, as you say, you know, there are a lot of people in prison in Turkey, a lot of politicians in jail in Turkey.
Yes.
What's the kind of significance of speaking about Öcalan's particular detention? Why was that a focus?
Because we think that Öcalan is a main player in the coming peace negotiations about Middle East and mostly Turkish repression to Iraq and Rojava.
A main player, how?
They had tried it before. They had peace negotiations between 2012 and 14, and Öcalan said that, give me a week and I will create peace in the Middle East. And that might sound tough, but I think he is the main player in this situation. I think Turkey is very, very well aware of that. I think that's why they broke the negotiations 2014, because then the Kurdish movement in Turkey was very successful, got a lot of strength and support, and made a very good election 2015.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, so the hope is that if Rojdan's able to participate in negotiations, that can then lead the way to a more democratic settlement within Turkey,
yes,
for all its residents. And how does that then link to, you know, of course, we're not speaking at the moment just about Turkey, but we're also thinking about Syria, we're thinking about Iraq, we're thinking about the crisis in Palestine, the related crisis, yes, in Yemen. What's the significance of the Kurdish issue and what's happening in Turkey and in Kurdistan to this whole regional crisis?
I think the Kurds play a very important role in the whole situation, mostly because of their political skills. You can see that the building of Rojava in the northeastern Syria has made the paradigm, the politics of Abdullah Öcalan to spread south in Syria all by itself. I mean, people in the small villages outside Rojava come to the conclusion that we have to do something about the situation. We have no bakery, we have no school, and it's mostly women who pick up those questions. So they start building, in a way, a democratic confederalism, but not connected to Rojava directly. And then I think the Kurds' way of using the third road in these aggressions between Turkey, Rojava, Iraq, and where also USA and Russia are involved, I think they have made a very good job in the diplomatic field.
Mm-hmm. So you spoke at the conference. What were the key themes that you discussed?
I brought up the importance of how we should work in Europe and the rest of the world to support and to be a part of the Kurdish peace movement. And I think that we should start locally, like Abdullah Öcalan discussed, with the so-called grassroots. And then I think the democratic confederalism will start as a small movement everywhere and then get to grow and become bigger and bigger. I mean, we should deal with the smallest problem that people have, and in that way make them understand what Abdullah Öcalan is talking about.
So your sense was that, as well as playing a role in the Middle East, some of these ideas can suggest policies or approaches for people in other countries and in other contexts.
Absolutely. Where I live, in a small village, we are like 800 people. And we are working like that. We have a democratic grassroots movement who, instead of going backwards as most rural parts in Sweden do, we have developed our little village. We own our own fire department, the grocery store, a lot of houses. We have a hostel and also apartments to rent.
Maybe you could say a little bit more about that. So as you developed this process in the village in Sweden, what were the challenges you faced and what are the benefits that you've got from that process?
The first challenge we got was when the commune, the bigger organization locally with like 25,000 inhabitants, they decided to close down our fire department. That was the start, I think. And we decided to start a union and to buy the fire department from the commune. And then we have developed a lot since then. Then we didn't have anything but the fire department, but people came up with ideas all the time, and we started to realize the best ones of them. And I think the best we did was to engage all people. The village on 800 people, we are divided into like 15 small villages inside, or who build this bigger village. And now people are active in every little part, and we are working with a lot of projects also to make our living more sustainable, coming to the environment and pollution and clean water and so on. We also have study circles when people join to study their history. And we have that too.
And did you see in this process, what you said earlier was you need to kind of identify the problems people have and help them to solve them.
Yes.
And did you feel people there in Sweden were open to working together like this? It was kind of building on,
really, in this small village. And then in the bigger city, which is Söderhamn, we have worked for the Kurdish freedom movement for 8, 9, 10 years. We have a twin city in Bakur, which is eastern Turkey, and it's Nusaybin. So Söderhamn and Nusaybin are twins, and their major and other employees have been to Söderhamn, and we have been to Nusaybin. I've been there, I think, 4 times. So we had a good relationship and were planning to cooperate, but then the Turkish government, after the election 2015, started to attack Nusaybin and almost destroyed the whole city. Something like 2/3 of the population had to leave and become refugees.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned as well as this community work, you've been involved in this broader kind of solidarity work with the Kurdish movement in Sweden.
Yes.
When we last spoke, you and I, we were talking about the kind of increasing repression that the Kurdish community there was facing, which seemed likely as a result of Sweden's move to join NATO and Turkey seeking concessions over that, in terms of Sweden changing its policy towards the Kurds, towards its own Kurdish community, and so on. How is the situation now in Sweden? How are the Kurdish community? Are they facing particular challenges?
Yes, they are. And I think a lot of the friends are worried about the situation and staying in Sweden, because Sweden has already started to expel Kurds from Sweden, send them to Turkey. Only from my little hometown, I know they have sent two friends, and they are now in Turkey.
In jail?
No, none of them, but under what do you call it? Under, yes. So I think the discussion about NATO has brought a lot of problems to the Kurds in Sweden. And the Kurds very clearly said that we don't take a stand on the NATO issue, but you can't use us as payment or bribes.
What do you think, or like, you know, ordinary people in Sweden think about this? Is the mood now we've got to be in NATO at any cost, and if that's what Turkey wants, it doesn't matter, or people aren't thinking about it? How is the general perspective?
I think there is a small majority for NATO in Sweden, but right before the discussion started, I think most people in Sweden were against NATO, but then came the war against Ukraine, and I think quite a lot of people changed their mind then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. Why do you think, in your perspective, you know, why should Erdogan be bothered about some Kurds living and working in towns in Sweden? Why, for him, it was worth holding up this whole NATO process to make these demands?
Yes.
Sometimes, you know, about what seemed like quite small, almost like Kurdish cultural issues in other countries. What's the point of going to all this trouble?
For Turkey, you mean?
Turkey, yeah.
I think he had a quite strong hand of cards by that. I mean, we saw the Swedish Prime Minister crawl for Erdogan. And even our foreign minister, they didn't stand up for human rights or international laws. But they bent their knees for Erdogan, I think.
And
we also started to sell weapons again to Turkey. We had an embargo before, but now it's all right to sell weapons to Mr. Erdogan.
Yeah, it was, a lot of countries in Europe introduced some kind of embargo after the 2019 invasion of Rojava, but often,
yes,
when you looked into it, it was, okay, we're not going to make any new weapons deals beside the weapons deals we already have, except we probably will in a couple of years, you know, something like this. Thank you for sharing this today. Maybe just as we come to the end, I'll just ask you a final question to come back to conference and the march that took place this weekend. Was there a particular speaker that you heard or a conversation you had that you found inspiring or interesting or something new that you would like to share?
Well, I can't really quote anyone, but I think all the speakers were interesting. Maybe I am very fond of Mr. Egmundur Jónasson from Iceland. He's a very bright man and has a lot of good ideas. I met him the first time, I think, when I was joining the Imrali delegation 4 or 5 years ago. And it was headed by Essa Musa, a lawyer from South Africa, who was the one who negotiated Mr. Mandela free. And then he was the president of the Supreme Court in South Africa. In his oldest day, he had decided to work for Abdullah Öcalan's freedom.
Yeah, these links are very important. I'm speaking to Ogmundur also for an interview at some time soon, which will be good, I'm sure.
Yes.
Thank you for joining us today. And I know that the Kurds appreciate all the international support and engagement they get, whether from South Africa, from Iceland, from Sweden. So thank you, Benny, for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, we appreciate your taking the time, as always. This has been the Kurdistan Connection with myself, Matt Broomfield, for Media News. Until the next program, goodbye.
Goodbye.